We're into Zechariah chapter 13. It's a bit sad, actually. We've only got one more chapter of Zechariah. Yeah, and then there's only four chapters in Malachi. We're nearly done with the minor prophets. What are we going to do next? I reckon we've been on them for about 2 years now, is it? Maybe more. Wing it. Just make it up. Now, as we start into Zechariah 13, there's quite a flow that comes out of chapter 12. So I just want to read the last part of chapter 12 from verse 10. It says, "And I'll pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. On that day, the weeping in Jerusalem will be as great as the weeping in Hadad-Rimon in the plain of Megiddo. The land will mourn, each clan by itself and their wives by themselves, the clan of the house of David and their wives, the clan of the house of Nathan and their wives, the clan of the house of Levi and their wives, the clan of Shimei and their wives, and all the rest of the clans and their wives." And, you know, it's one of those things, talking about when grace enters into your life and you realise the impact of the foolishness of the way that we've lived, how the price of our sin, of our rebellion against God, and we look on the one whom they've pierced, whom we've pierced, and the response to that when God has entered our hearts with the spirit of grace and supplication is, first of all, grief. And we weep because we recognize the gravity of our sin and the effect that it's had, not only on our lives, but on the price that he had to pay for us. And it's interesting that the mourning that goes with that and the grieving is something that happens both corporately and individually. And as we sort of read through the way the weeping happens, it says that the land will mourn, each clan by itself, with their wives and themselves. So there's a grief that happens not only, that first of all happens individually by yourself, but also something that happens corporately as well. So the way that's described and the impact that that response to the sacrifice of Christ happens individually and corporately. And that's our experience in church, that, you know, when we consider our sin, we grieve individually, but also corporately. And as God sort of blesses, then things happen individually and corporately, because that's the way the Trinity works, that when we live in community, when we live in family, that as it says elsewhere, that when one part suffers, all parts suffer, and when one part rejoices, every part rejoices. I'm off on a tangent there. I wasn't going to get into that. But so we're coming off of this sort of section where we look. It says that they're looking on the one whom they've pierced. And verse 1 of chapter 13 says, "On that day, a fountain will be opened to the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and impurity." Now, it's important that we read this section in light of the fact that Jesus has been pierced for our transgressions. And that as we're pierced, as he is pierced for our transgressions, then on that same day a fountain is opened to the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And the fountain is there to cleanse us, or cleanse the people, from their sin and impurity. Psalm 36 verse 7 says, "How priceless is your unfailing love, O God. People take refuge in the shadow of your wings. They feast on the abundance of your house. You give them drink from your river of delights. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light." And so this fountain is spoken of as being a fountain of righteousness that flows out on that day. And as the psalmist says, in his light, we see light. Until we have had our eyes open to the righteousness of God, we have no grid for understanding righteousness. But in his light, when he comes in and changes us, then suddenly we have the capacity to see what righteousness is and what his heart is. And we take refuge in that there's an abundance and a blessing that comes with the fountain of God. Now, one of the themes that we see running through the book of Zechariah is the theme of the Feast of Tabernacles. Remembering that we start out talking about the exiles returning from Babylon, they're rebuilding the temple, which was destroyed by the Babylonians. But as they're doing that, Zechariah is prophesying in and he's saying this temple is just a bit of a shadow because it's pointing to the true temple, who is Jesus. And not only that, but the temple that Jesus establishes becomes a living temple, which will be the church, because as individual members, we're living stones in this temple. And Paul says our body has become the temple of the Holy Spirit. So we need to understand this thing of temple or tabernacle, which is a theme that carries throughout the book of Zechariah. And when we go to Deuteronomy chapter 16, where it talks about the Feast of Tabernacles, it says, Deuteronomy 16 and verse 13, celebrate the festival of tabernacles for 7 days after you have gathered the produce of your threshing floor and your winepress. Be joyful at your festival, you, your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levites, the foreigners, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns. For 7 days celebrate the festival to the Lord your God at the place the Lord will choose. For the Lord your God will bless you in all your harvest and in all the work of your hands, and your joy will be complete. Now, without going into too much detail, when you look at the sacrifices that are required for the festival of tabernacles, it's a pretty long list. There's a lot of blood being poured out during the festival of, or the Feast of Tabernacles. And I want to sort of highlight in verse 14 of Deuteronomy 16, it says, be joyful at your festival. And the word that's translated joyful there is a word that talks about gushing forth. So, you know, overflowing joy, like a spring or a fountain, we have this gushing out of joy as an expression of thanks to God because he's brought us out of Egypt, as it were, and he's led us through the wilderness into a place of promise. Now, the interesting thing is that the word that's used there for joyful is the same word that is implied when it says that Jesus' side was pierced and blood and water came gushing out. And so there's this link occurring between when Jesus was pierced on the cross and the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay? There's great sacrifice, but in the midst of great sacrifice, there's also great joy. And the sacrifice and the joy have mingled together. So that on that day, a fountain is opened for the house of Israel, or for the people of God. And it's a fountain that mixes suffering and joy, that through death there's life released. And this is the pattern that we see throughout the scriptures then, that the church is founded on the rock, Jesus, the cornerstone. Zechariah talks a lot about that. Talks about the city of peace, the city of truth, the city of righteousness being the new Jerusalem that's being established. And what we see is that the church then is built upon Christ as the foundation. And then the apostles sort of lay upon that foundation, and we continue to build the tabernacle on the foundation that's been laid before, but understanding that the foundation is not a foundation of power in the sense of strength or might, the power of the new Jerusalem, the tabernacle, is one of sacrifice and one of suffering. And so we see that as the church begins to expand, it expands through persecution and suffering and difficulty and perseverance under trials. When we look at the book of Revelation, and there's encouragement there for the churches, and the churches that are commended are the ones that are enduring difficulties, but they remain true and they remain faithful. The churches that are comfortable, they get a good serve from the Holy Spirit saying you've got to get your heart back to where it first was, because you've drifted. You've become comfortable. And as we've talked about, the saying that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, that it's the perseverance under trial, it's the endurance under difficulty that actually forges the church and causes it to grow, because that's the foundation that it was laid on. The fountain that gushed forth to give us life was one that was given forth through pain and suffering and sacrifice. And Paul says that, talking about the church, he says, I'm glad that I've suffered the things that I've suffered, because it was to your benefit. The things that I had to endure, you are blessed as a result of that. And that's always been the pattern of the church. That in one sense, Paul uses the phrase, he says, I'm filling up the sufferings of Christ. And so we need to have a mindset that doesn't say that comfort and blessing is our goal. Christ is our goal, becoming more like Him is our goal. And if we go through difficult circumstances, if we go through trials of many kinds, it says, whether that be persecution or sometimes it's sickness, sometimes, the whole heap of things that we endure through. But if we do so unto Him, then we can know that it bears fruit for the kingdom in the long term. Verse 2 says, on that day I will banish the names of the idols from the land, and they will be remembered no more, declares the Lord Almighty. I will remove both the prophets and the spirit of impurity from the land. And if anyone still prophesies, their father and mother to whom they were born will say to them, you must die because you have told lies in the Lord's name. Then their own parents will stab the one who prophesies. Harsh words. It kind of reminds us, actually, this first part of Zechariah reminds me of Hosea chapter 2. If you can remember right back to Hosea, who was the first of the line of prophets that we looked at. And in chapter 2, we've got this, do you remember, it's like a divorce court. Hosea's dealing with an unfaithful wife, but God says, this is a symbol of my relationship with Israel. Israel's been unfaithful. And so in chapter 2, he, if you like, brings Israel into a divorce court to say, this is how you've been unfaithful to me and how you've broken the marriage covenant with me. And he lists off all these things, and it's a terrible indictment. And you're expecting God to say, because of these things, I divorce you and you're out of my house. But he doesn't. What he says in verse 16 is, in that day, and we've got this same phrase here, in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day, I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds in the sky, and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land, so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. So we have this promise from God that he is going to establish a new covenant. It's a new marriage relationship. The Israel that was unfaithful, he's taken her out into the desert and he's dealt with her. And as a result of those dealings, he's established a new covenant in that day. And we've seen how God dealt with Israel, how there were chastisements along the way, right up to and including the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Because he was establishing a new city, a new Israel, a new people that he was going to bring to himself so that they wouldn't be calling him my master. Because my master is... There's a bit of a play on words there because Baal, the idols that the Canaanites would worship, the word Baal means master. And so God's saying, you're not going to serve me like you're serving these idols. It's not like we're not in a relationship of religion here where you're trying to keep the gods happy so that you can live a comfortable life. He's talking about a marriage relationship where we come into the life of his household and we share the benefits of his household. But with those benefits comes the responsibility of faithfulness within the house. And so we'll no longer call him Baal or my master, but we'll call him my husband. We come into an intimacy with him, which is much greater than we could ever have had before. And more than that, he betroths us in righteousness. See, what happened on that day when Jesus was pierced, actually before that, when he entered into humanity, he became one of us. God became a man. And he's never gone, he hasn't left his humanity, because it says that there's one who intercedes for us at the right hand of God, and that is the man, Christ Jesus. See, he's married himself or betrothed himself to mankind because he's become one of us, and he's done it in righteousness. He's satisfied all of the righteous requirements to deal with the penalty of sin and yet maintain a life relationship with us. And he's done it in justice and in love and compassion, and he's betrothed us in faithfulness. And what's our response? We acknowledge the Lord. So what he's done is he's removed the names of the idols from our mouths by coming with a spirit of grace and supplication and changing our relationship with him so that we become, if you like, his bride. And we enter into a life relationship with him rather than a relationship of just pure obedience out of a desire to see our lives comfortable. Now our hearts are after him. We want to see his truth and his life at work in ours because he's changed the way we think. And so as the idols are removed, so are the false prophets. Now this is talking quite specifically about false prophets, as we'll see in a minute. In Matthew 24, when Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, you know, they're saying, you know, what's the deal with the temple? Jesus said, well, it's going to be destroyed, and these are the signs that are going to happen when you see that before the temple is destroyed. And one of the things is, he says in verse 24 of Matthew 24, false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. We see again in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 1, it says, dear friends, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they're from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. This is how you can recognize the Spirit of God. Every spirit that acknowledges that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God, but every spirit that does not acknowledge Jesus is not from God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard is coming and is now... and even now is already in the world. You, dear children, are from God and have overcome them, because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. They are from the world and therefore speak from the viewpoint of the world, and the world listens to them. We are from God, and whoever knows God listens to us. But whoever is not from God does not listen to us. This is how we recognize the spirit of truth and the spirit of falsehood. You see, when we're, if our relationship to God is as master, and we serve him as master only for our comfort, then we are easily misled by false prophets, because they prophesy comfort to bring people to them. And they prophesy peace and safety and all those things. And, you know, sometimes God does that, but there's a difference between a false prophet and someone who proclaims the truth of God. And so this is saying, on that day when the relationship changes and you come into a faithful marriage relationship with God through the sacrifice of Christ, then you're going to have a real hatred for the things that are false, that speak falsely about who God is. Because he's our husband now, just like if someone spoke falsely about, you know, someone's husband, you'd get upset. And that's because their heart's been changed, and this is the response that we have to the truth of God, because he's changed us. And it says in verse 4, on that day, every prophet will be ashamed of their prophetic visions. They will not put on a prophet's garment of hair in order to deceive. Each will say, I'm not a prophet, I'm a farmer. The land has been my livelihood since my youth. If someone asks, what are these wounds on your body? They will answer, the wounds I was given at the house of my friends. So it's established there that these are false prophets who have deliberately set out to deceive people. They put on the garments of prophets, the clothing of hair, which is kind of to symbolize their humility. They're not going to put those on anymore. And in fact, they're going to go and say, no, actually, I'm not a prophet. I didn't say those things. I've been a farmer all my life, you know, never dealt in prophecy. Again, they're behaving deceptively, of course. And then it says, if someone asks, what are these wounds on your body? Now, why would there be wounds on their body? A couple of reasons. The idolatrous sort of practice with the false prophets and false gods was to mutilate themselves, to work themselves into a frenzy, to reach a state of ecstasy so that they would get these visions that they would then proclaim. Very demonic sort of activity. And so if people said, well, why have you got these wounds on your body? Because we know that's what prophets do, just like prophets wear garments of hair. And they'll go, oh, no, I was roughhousing with my friends at their house, wrestling or whatever, and that's where I got these. They're going to deny their practices and blame their wounds on their friends. Interestingly, though, the true prophet Jesus was wounded at the house of his friends. John chapter 1 and verse 9 says, the true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who do receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. See, we know who the true prophets are because they're the ones who glorify Jesus. That's what the word tells us. But if they're out to bring attention to themselves or to you, or to anything else, then they're deceivers, because they're trying to lead in idolatry. Because idolatry is any devotion to anything other than God. And so the sign of this new people, the church, is a hatred for the things that lead us away from him. So much so that we want to put those things down. Now, this is not saying that you should go around stabbing people if they prophesy and you don't think. We've already established Jerusalem is a city of peace, okay? It's not a city of might. But it's talking about the heart attitude. We need to be ready to cut through and put the deception to death, okay? To put it down, because the word of God is like a sword, and it pierces even to the joints and the marrow. It divides the soul, things of the soul, and the things of the spirit. And as we devote ourselves to Him, then we can be quick to put to death the false proclamations of the false prophets, because we're grounded in His truth. Verse 7 says, "Awake, sword, against my shepherd, against the man who is close to me, declares the Lord Almighty." Sorry, the Lord Almighty. "Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered, and I will turn my hand against the little ones." Jesus, talking to his disciples, said in Mark 14, verse 27, "You will all fall away," Jesus told them, "for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. But afterward, after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." See, we need our shepherd. And when Jesus was crucified, the disciples were completely lost, and they were scattered in fear of their lives, not knowing what's going on. But Jesus had told them, "It's all right. You will be scattered, but I'm going to go ahead of you into Galilee." And that's what he did. That's where, you know, they went fishing on the Lake of Galilee, and there was Jesus making breakfast for them on the shore. And from there he gathered them in again. But it's a pattern that is echoed throughout. In Acts chapter 8 and verse 1, it says, speaking about the persecution on the church, that Saul approved of the killing of Stephen. "And on that day a great persecution broke out against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. Godly men buried Stephen and mourned deeply for him. But Saul began to destroy the church. Going from house to house, he dragged off both men and women and put them in prison. Those who had been scattered preached the word wherever they went. Philip went down to a city in Samaria and proclaimed the Messiah there. And when the crowds heard Philip and saw the signs he performed, they all paid close attention to what he said. For with shrieks, impure spirits came out of many, and many who were paralyzed or lame were healed. So there was great joy in that city." Our tendency as people is to stay close together. We're kind of, you know, like sheep. We tend to herd. You know, we don't like to. We want to stay close to the source. But there's a saying: if you don't do Acts 1:8, which is go into all the world and preach the gospel, then you get Acts 8:1, which is that a great persecution broke out in the church and all were scattered throughout the land. But what happened in the scattering was that as they went, they preached the gospel and plundered the nations around them, because they were bringing people into the kingdom constantly. And there are times when God will move and he'll, as it were, strike the shepherd so that we get scattered. But as that happens, the gospel then gets spread and the kingdom expands. As I said, the way of the kingdom is often through difficulty and suffering, and the places where the church experiences persecution is usually the place where it grows the fastest, because it's the way of our foundation. Verse 8 says, "In the whole land, declares the Lord, two-thirds will be struck down and perish, yet one-third will be left in it. The third I will put into the fire. I will refine them like silver and test them like gold. They will call on my name and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people. And they will say, the Lord is our God." Now, this concept of a third we see quite a bit in the scriptures, where God's judgment moves and it's usually two-thirds are destroyed and one-third remains. It speaks of the remnant of the people. That God always retains a faithful remnant when he comes in judgment. And we see it time and time again. Elijah was moaning about, you know, he was the only one left, and God says, well, no, actually, I've still got 1,000 men that are faithful and that they, you know, they won't bow to the wickedness that's around them. And then that third is refined and tested, because the interesting thing about the third, you know how we talk about the thing, if we want to understand something, we go to where it's first mentioned in the scripture, and the third kind of thing comes out because on the third day was the day when God brought fruitfulness from the earth. He caused the crops and the trees to grow up out of the ground and bear fruit. And so when we see God maintaining a third as a remnant, it's talking about fruitfulness, that there's a remnant that remains and it's fruitful. And what we do with fruit is we process it. And so that's what he says is going to happen, that the third that doesn't perish, he's going to put to the fire and refine them like silver, test them like gold. And they will call on my name and I will answer them. And I'll say, they are my people. And they'll say, the Lord is our God. Because refining is all about removing impurities. It's about getting rid of the stuff that is not part of its true nature. And that's what the difficulties in life do for us, as we rub up against one another in the church and, you know, have difficulties with one another. It actually reveals to us the impurities in our own hearts, the selfishness and the, you know, our self-centeredness and our reliance on our way. And God changes us. It's one of the blessings of family. You get opportunity to be tested and refined. And the struggles that we have in life are also refinements. They prove us. You know, as it talks about, you know, enduring under trials, because it will show you of greater worth than gold. You know, there's this refinement that happens when we have difficulties in life and we continue to seek God, and he changes us through those times. And then once we've been refined, there has to be a testing. And the reason there's a testing is to prove the worth of what's left. We tend to think of tests in a negative way. Students at my school have got exams this week coming up. Actually, a lot of students in all sorts of schools have got exams this week. And, you know, one of the things I say to students from time to time is that, look, don't stress about the exam. I'm not trying to find out what you don't know. It's an opportunity for you to show me what you do know. Okay, it's a test so that you can prove your learning, so that you can glory in your learning and rejoice in the things that you've come to understand. And that's what testing is about. It's about proving the things that God's changed in us. It's about glorying in, giving glory to him for the way that he's transformed us and purified us. And so when we go through those tests, after he's refined us, he'll test us. But it's not to give us a hard time or to cause us to fail. It's so that we can prove that he has changed us, so that he gets the glory. John 15, verse 1 says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does not bear fruit he prunes, so that it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me as I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I'm the vine. You're the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. See, this is the intimacy of marriage, that he was pierced and a fountain was released of life, and he welcomes us into his household so that we come into this intimacy with him. He comes in and he starts to change us, but we only change as we are intimate with him. We can't change ourselves, otherwise we're just treating him as our master if we try and go off and do the job ourselves. But out of intimacy with him, we are transformed as we knit ourselves into the vine, because apart from him, we can't do anything. But in him, he can accomplish all things through us. Verse 6, if you do not remain in me, you're like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. This is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so I love you. So have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. I've told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. You see, as we come into this relationship with God, our relationship to the covenant changes, so that we don't keep the commandments to satisfy God so he'll stay off our backs and our lives can be untroubled. We keep his commands because we love him and we want to do the things that delight him, because we're knitted into him and we have relationship with him. Verse 12, my command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you, so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. And this is my command: love each other. Because the love that we have for one another is the fruit that shows that we have been knitted into him, that we're grafted into the vine, that we've come to share in the fountain of God that was established through his sacrifice.